You're listening to Trucking with Authority with Kenny Long. Now is the best time in a long time to take the leap and become a motor carrier. We'll dispel the rumors, teach you how to avoid the scams, take your questions, and give you the tools you need to get your own authority and get the success you deserve. Let's head down the audio road and start trucking with authority.
Welcome to the show. This is Trucking with Authority, and thank you for joining me. This show is to help you on your journey to success. My name is Kenny Long, and for the next hour, I'm here to be your navigator on that journey. This show is all about you, your journey in life, your journey in business, and your journey to reach your goals. My job as navigator is simply to put you, to help you read the map, and sometimes help you draw your own map. We can discuss anything from setting a goal to forming a plan, strategizing that plan, and then executing the plan. My goal is to help you reach your goal. We can talk anything tonight about getting started as a driver, starting a business as an owner-operator, becoming a motor carrier, growing a fleet, and pulling your own freight under your own authority, shippers, using load boards, factoring companies, negotiations, sales and marketing. And the one thing that all of those categories have in common is contracts. And tonight, contracts is on the list. I try to start each show with a quote. And tonight, the quote is, "When two men in business always agree, one of them is unnecessary." That quote is by William Wrigley Jr., founder of the Wrigley Chewing Gum Company, telling, quote, "Because anybody can agree on anything. And it's not just coming to an agreement. It's coming to an agreement that we can live by and stick with long term. And that is a contract. A contract is simply an agreement that you will commit to." Try to sort out my notes here quick. The one contract that we all commit to from the time that we're very young, sometimes by choice, sometimes by force, sometimes just by the country that we're born in, and that's a social contract. A social contract is something that we're all expected to abide by. We may or may not agree with the contract that we're forced to be under, but it's something we all recognize, a moral compass. Social contracts are something that we are all just expected to do. Now, social contracts are negotiable, just like everything else. In fact, every time you watch a debate on TV, you are looking at a negotiation to social contracts. We're negotiating on the freedoms that we may sacrifice in order to gain other abilities, other rights, sometimes natural rights or sometimes legal rights. And those are all up for debate. Those are all arguable. Those are all negotiation chips in life. In our social contract, with our government, our social government contract, our social moral contract between the people, those are all negotiable concepts. And we all have an opinion of those. There's a division sometimes, and it's obvious in politics, between what some people want versus what other people want. Those are the points that we negotiate upon. The give and take. And as I said, a negotiation is part of every contract. Before a contract can be finalized, a negotiation must take place. So, important to understand that a contract is simply an agreement. Now, there's another old English proverb that says, a verbal agreement is only as good as the paper it's written on. So, yes, there is something to be said with the social contract and the paper that our verbal agreements are written on. We have a moral compass that tells us that we must fulfill the promises that we make. But, as my other quote says, if two people can always agree, one of them is unnecessary. It's almost impossible to go into business with someone and have an agreement on everything all of the time. Now, that could be getting a job as an employee, become a contractor, leasing a truck onto a carrier, or become a full motor carrier, and you begin working with shippers and brokers, receivers, lumpers, maybe other owner-operators. And I can tell you that it's almost impossible to agree on everything all of the time. That's why we like to have written contracts. The only way to assure that you can maintain a contract is to have it on paper. So anytime that there is a long-term contract, especially if there is a lot of valuable negotiation points on that contract, it's important to have it in writing. So, the first tip about contracts is read them. Always, always, always read your contracts. A written contract, once it is written and it's agreed upon and signed and maybe notarized, or you've gone in front of a judge over this or anything like that, it, once that contract is formed, that is the agreement that you've made that is now a legally binding agreement and cannot be changed without breaking that contract. So always read everything. As an employee, read what your contractors expect of you. Or read what your employer expects of you. Read what the carrier expects of you. And so we'll start with employees. What contracts might an employee have when they first start? Now, recently, and the reason that I'm doing this show on contracts, I've talked about contracts in the past. The reason I'm doing it again is because I'm beginning to hear more and more complaints, and I believe it has something to do with the freight market right now. Here we are. It's February 9th, 2016. Fuel prices are the lowest they've been in years. I heard today that the barrel of oil, for the first time in almost a decade, dropped below $28 a barrel. The fuel prices are reflecting at the pump. Commodity prices across the board are dropping. And frankly, trucks are a commodity. The trucking industry is a commodity. As long as it's cheap to ship, as long as it's cheap to make, as long, you know, all of these things are all tied in together. And so when prices get slim, wages start coming down, the profit margins of everybody start coming down, the shippers, the receivers, the brokers, everybody starts losing money on their overall profit margins, and so they start looking at ways to save money elsewhere, and they start cutting into their contracts. So I'm seeing that now with employees. I'm seeing that with owner-operators. I'm seeing that with brokers and shippers, the way they're working with carriers. They're going back on some of the agreements that they made in their contracts. And sometimes they expect that you never read them and they don't think you'll catch them. So again, it's very important to read and understand the contracts before you agree to them, before you make that agreement. So the types of things that an employee might need to read is, how about unions? Now, unions have a contract or negotiate on the employee's behalf with the company. Now, it's not just trucking. It's all unions with whatever company they represent. The unions negotiate on behalf of the employee to the employer and form a contract. That contract becomes between the employee and the employer. But that employee also has a contract with the union. They must also pay union dues. They must also abide by the rules that are laid out by the union. Some of those might be if the union calls a strike, that it's your obligation by the contract you have with that union to follow suit and support that strike. And these are all things that are in that union contract. Even if you don't have a contract with a union, you may still have some type of a contract with your employer. Some of that might just be part of that social contract we discussed before. The expectations, the moral compass, doing the right thing on your job, showing up on time, not stealing, following some type of code of conduct. And maybe a code of conduct is in writing. And it's very important that if they give you some type of a code of conduct or written handbook, that you read that and understand it. Because even though that might not be something that you have to sign and commit to, if you accept a job and that is their code of conduct, that is a contract that you are agreeing with. If you break their code of conduct, you may find yourself unemployed. So this code of conduct might be a list of expectations, such as a dress code. Specify possibly the type of work you'll be doing. As truck drivers, we obviously might be expected to drive a truck, but what if we're also expected to unload and load our own trailers? All of that should be specified. If that's in your contract when you get the job, and you get to your first customer and you refuse to load or unload the trailer, you'll find yourself unemployed. And unfortunately, I've recently talked to someone that thought that that was egregious. They could not believe that that was part of the deal. Well, guess what? When you hired on, that was what you agreed to. Even though they didn't sign that specific line and they didn't have a written contract per se that they signed, that was what you agreed to when you took the job. It was an agreement. So a contract with an employee, with a union, with or without, to the employer, is some type of written or unwritten agreement to do some service in exchange for money or possibly other benefits, health benefits, retirement funds, all of which are part of the contract, the wages that you get paid, the amount that you get paid. How many people have started a job and never had an agreement on how much they would get paid? I'm sure a lot of people have, but that's part of the contract. Why would you start working someplace, haul a load without knowing how much you'll get paid on that load? Start an hourly job without knowing how much you get paid hourly and never negotiate that, never discuss that, and have no idea what you're getting into. All of this is part of the contract that you need to read and understand. Now, in freight, in the transportation industry, specifically trucking, all of the parties that are involved include the carrier, the owner-operator, the driver. All of those are obvious. But then you also have the shipper, the receiver, insurance companies, possibly lumpers, brokers, freight forwarders, all of these, and they all have one thing in common. Each one of those will have their own contract with you and with each other, each one of those. But they all fall under one specific contract, and that is the bill of lading. So before I go any further, let me invite you all to go ahead and press 1 if you have any questions or comments. Press 1. Elizabeth is screening calls tonight. She will get you on the air. If you have anything related to the trucking industry whatsoever, and especially as it applies to any contracts that you may have been in or any questions you may have, we'll see if we can get you some answers. I also want to go ahead and refer you to a source, which is transportationlaw.net. Many of you have heard on Rico Muhammad's show on Wednesday nights on Rates and Lanes. Attorney Hank Seaton comes on once a month, and his website is transportationlaw.net, and he has countless resources available to understand all about these contracts. And he even has a book that you can purchase, and a lot of the information here, he covers it in layman's terms, helps you understand everything that you need to know. And a lot of it will be covered here tonight, but I'm going to cover bullet points because I have about 45 minutes left. I will cover bullet points. And believe me, there are novels that could be written on each one of these, and Mr. Seaton does a great job of breaking it all down. Bill of lading. The one thing that the bill of lading has in common is everyone. The bill of lading encompasses all parties, everybody, shipper, receiver, carrier, broker, owner, operator, employee, driver, insurance companies, freight forwarders, everybody. They all refer to that bill of lading. And because they all refer to a bill of lading, that makes the bill of lading the single most important document of every single load you pull. And it's very important to understand that that's a very important document because most people, myself included when I first started this game, draw a line at the bottom of it, very rarely even read what's on it, and move on, shut the doors or strap my load down and hit the road, get to the other end, give it to them, they scribble something on it, I give it in to whoever I need to get paid. Too many people treat the bill of lading that way, never reading what's on it, never looking to see what it says. The bill of lading is by far the single most important document. It's a legal document. It's a federal regulated document. Well, it used to be. And it will hold up in court. If there are no other agreements between any other parties, the bill of lading is the only thing necessary. And who gets paid, who pays who, when they get paid, how claims and losses are handled, who is responsible for paying on not just the freight bill itself, but on these claims and losses. So the bill of lading is by far the most important. And I've said that a few times. I'll say it again. The bill of lading is the most important document of the entire transaction, of the entire load, every single time. Every single bill of lading you get is the most important document. So, a few important things to understand. First of all, who supplies the bill of lading? I wish I had some Jeopardy music to play right now. Who supplies the bill of lading? I hope you all said the carrier. Because that's the answer. The carrier supplies the bill of lading. The carrier is responsible for supplying the bill of lading, not the shipper, not the broker, the carrier. So who's responsible if there's a mistake on the bill of lading? So if the broker or carrier, or shipper rather, if the broker or shipper supply the bill of lading and there's something false, inaccurate, or some other discrepancy on the load, and all of those involved parties, the shipper, the receiver, the insurance company, the broker, the carrier, the owner-operator, all of those parties get involved, and that bill of lading is the one document they turn to, and it's wrong, who is liable? The carrier. So, again, as a carrier, that bill of lading needs to be harshly looked at for every single load, and it's something that you need to, if you are the driver, you need to train yourself very well on what to look for, and if you have drivers working for you, you need to explain to them exactly what they need. Now, here's a few common problems. Probably the biggest problem that we see often that is often overlooked is there is no bill of lading. A lot of times with produce, happens a lot with produce, but it happens with other freight as well. What happens when the shipper hands the driver a packing list? It lists all of the materials that went in the load, and that's it. It might list some dollar amounts or who's paying the bill. It's basically an invoice, usually, to the final user. But it has absolutely nothing to do with the shipment. That is not a bill of lading, and it is basically worthless to you. A driver and a carrier have no interest in a packing list. A packing list is completely worthless as it comes to the contractual obligations that you have with all of the regulations that FMCSA puts on, with shippers and receivers, with brokers, to have a bill of lading. Packing list just won't cut it. So that's the very first thing that we need to pay attention to. You must have a bill of lading. Now, we have a lot of callers on the line tonight. Any of you that has accepted a load and they gave you a bill of lading, press 1. I want to hear about it. If you have any other questions or comments, go ahead and press number 1. I'd love to hear your take on all of these things. There's been a lot of recent questions and concerns and things that have been brought up on Facebook. Our last show, which was 2 weeks ago, I couldn't make it last week, but our last show, we had Hadley and Leiden insurance agents on, and we had talked slightly about some of the contracts and how the insurance agents look at these contracts. It's important to understand the relationship there. Going back to the bill of lading, and press 1. Everybody press 1 if you have any questions or comments. Now, I do have to cut the show off tonight at 8 o'clock, so get your questions in early. If I don't get to everybody tonight, I will have to cut you short. So get your questions in. If you have any questions or comments, go ahead and get on here now, because at 8 o'clock, whether I have callers waiting or not, I will have to cut you short. So back to the bill of lading. Now, with the bill of lading, you have to understand also the Carmack Amendment and how that will apply. Now, the Carmack Amendment spells out the rights, duties, and liabilities for all of the parties involved on how to handle cargo loss. That involves possibly a carrier's lien, salvage rights, and who is responsible to pay any loss. And the bill of lading is very specific in spelling those out. Now, once upon a time, way back when, the trucking industry was heavily regulated. Many of you have heard the term of deregulation. So once upon a time, when the industry was regulated, and I will add that other segments of the transportation industry, meaning the and rail, are still heavily regulated. But prior to the highway transportation being deregulated, there was a uniform or standard bill of lading. Since deregulation, there have been numerous attempts at creating bill of ladings that may or may not fit all of the legalities that are required to be an official bill of lading. Hence, we have people submitting a packing list. Coming on right now, I think I will take one right now because this is where I was going with my next question. Tarina in South Carolina, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, my question, because you just hit on a bill of lading. I always, because I'm a company driver right now, but I am thinking about going into owner operation. And every time that I go, it's the shipper that gives me the bill of lading. So if the shipper doesn't provide the bill of lading, where do we go to get our own bill of lading? Like, is that something we carry with us every single time once you become an owner-operator? Can you just elaborate on that? Because, you know, like, one of the things that I often see that's missed that my company asks for is, like, who's paying for it? Is it prepaid? Do I collect it? You know, those kind of questions.
Right, and that's a great question. Now, I will say that if you lease, as an owner-operator, lease to a carrier, as the owner-operator, it's technically not your responsibility to supply it. It will be the carrier. Now, the carrier okay. will delegate that onto you. And so, for example, for me, what I will do is I will supply a bill of lading, and I will either fax or email it to my driver to have them print it off for the customer. It happens a couple times a month usually. And the way that you can get a bill of lading, and if you move on to becoming a carrier, they have blank forms at truck stops. They have forms, blank forms you can get from J.J. Keller. You can get blank forms online. You can create your own if you have a spreadsheet, if you'd like to create your own bill of lading. But something that's extremely important to understand is, once upon a time, the Uniform Bill of Lading was regulated, and it had a lot of legal power because that bill of lading was specific to every shipment. And it was a form, almost like a tax form. And it, every box on that form had a specific purpose. Well, since deregulation, there have been various forms of a bill of lading. Now, have you ever been, and I still have you on, Sharina, have you ever been to a shipper or a receiver, when they hand you the bill of lading, there's a backside to it, and it's almost all small print, almost a full page of small print?
Yes. And I've been the one where they actually have to fill it in themselves, and you know, I'm somewhat knowledgeable that what has to be on there, but I have to say, you know, not very well, not just, you know, what you learn in training at the CDL, when you get your CDL.
Right. Okay. Now, if you have one of those forms that's a full page, what that explains is the legal requirements of each box, as I mentioned. It explains what each one of those categories, just as if you filled out a tax form, you fill out your 1040 at the end of the year, and you go to the instructions, and it tells you that in the instructions, this box corresponds to this number, and this box is this taxable amount, and this box means this, right? On the bill of lading, if you, a true bill of lading, if you flip it over and it has that entire page of instructions, that's what that does, and that breaks down exactly how that bill of lading is to be used. Now, if you take that bill of lading, the full, true bill of lading like that, that has a lot more power than if you have a one-page document and you do not have any of that supporting documentation. Because typically, when they give you that one-page document, it's a photocopy or some made-up bill of lading that has no form or manner on how it should be treated. So it may have all the pertinent information, but it's all up to interpretation at that point. So now I will say that the bill of lading, the standard bill of lading, as I said, was originated from the rail and water industries, but you can still find all of the requirements published and regulated on 49 CFR 1035. And that will give you a free and completely legal bill of lading, complete top to bottom. I cannot vouch for any of the ones that you buy at the truck stop or J.J. Keller. I'd like to think that some of those companies would have all of the true and correct legalities of 49 CFR 1035, but the only way to know for sure is to go to that site and check for yourself. Okay. And there's actually a standard form there as well. Everything is listed, and that is what they would call a standard bill of lading. Now, the other and probably most powerful bill of lading available, and most of the bigger carriers are a member of the ATA, National Motor Freight Traffic Association, NMFTA, which is part of the ATA. If you're a member of that, you can use their copyrighted version of a bill of lading. Now, there's only about 100 carriers that are a member of that. A couple hundred dollars to join. But if you really want to get their bill of lading, you join and you can use it. That one is probably the most enforceable in court and most recognized. But, again, you can go to the actual U.S. Code, 49 CFR 1035, and pull the legally defined bill of lading, which is just as enforceable in court, and that is free and published. Now, there's important things that all of this has to contain, and there's some important things that you really need to watch out for. Now, there's some red flags that I like to train all of my drivers to watch out for, some bullet points, some very important topics that all of my drivers need to understand. All bill of lading contain this, and these are the most important. And the number one, most important, number one, is the name of the carrier. Now, as I said, the number one of the biggest problems is when they don't actually give you a bill of lading, they give you a packing list. But worse than that is, or just as bad at least, is they give you a bill of lading and it doesn't have the carrier's name on it. And this happens oftentimes when the shipper will have the broker's name, or they may have a different carrier's name, maybe they have a contract carrier that does 100 loads a week for them, and you're doing, you know, an overflow load. They never change their form, so it puts the wrong carrier on that form. Now, that's extremely important, and the main reason is, as I said, the bill of lading is the one document that all parties turn to, including your insurance company. So what happens when you have a claim and your insurance company pulls up the single most important document that describes all of the details to the load, and on the very top line it says carrier is somebody else? You may not get paid. That one little two-second fix, cross that off and put the carrier's name, that may be the difference between a several hundred thousand or, God forbid, million-dollar cargo claim because the carrier's name is not listed properly. Now, of course, you could go to court, you get some attorneys, and you could fight that back and forth, and I'm sure eventually you'd win. But why would you go through all that when all you have to do is cross that off and write the proper carrier name? That's all it takes. The number one thing on a bill of lading is to make sure that the carrier's name is listed, not a broker and not a shipper. It's extremely important. Some shippers, I will say, have a problem with that. They won't let you cross that off. They won't let you change it. It's actually a legal requirement that the carrier's name is on that document. Now, I don't think it's worth getting in a fist fight over at the shipper. You may have to negotiate with them and explain the legal requirement. It's a requirement that the carrier's name is on the bill of lading. If they don't let you completely cross it out and completely delete it and put yours, then at least try to notate on the side next to carrier's name, or even when you sign the document at the bottom showing that it's received, put carrier's name there. The shipper should understand, if it's a brokered load, the shipper should understand that that broker is not the carrier and the carrier's name should go there. If it's not there, explain it to them. Should not have a problem with it. If they do, just work with them to the best of your ability. We're going to take another call. We'll go to Joe in Nebraska. Joe, how can we help you?
Hey, this is Joe, owner of Rock Creek Enterprises, with my own authority. I had a question of, when I go to a shipper and they supply a bill of lading, am I required to use theirs, or could I demand to use my own supplied bill of lading?
You're not required to use theirs by any legal definition of it. As I said, the carrier is supposed to supply the bill of lading, and you could certainly make up your own copy and give it to them. Treat theirs as a packing list if they insist that you take it. They should have a copy of the legal document that you plan and intend on using. Now, some shippers, and again, I'm explaining this because a lot of people don't understand how the bill of lading works. So shippers get tired of the carriers coming in or the drivers coming in and giving them some document that's nonsense. Or they have 100 carriers come in and every one of them gives a different paper because it's no longer a uniform bill of lading. So shippers, for their own convenience, like to use what they supply, typically, or brokers, what they supply. But certainly, as a carrier, you can supply it. And you, as the carrier, again, are required to make sure that what's on that document is correct, so you can change what they have.
Now, can I, when I sign their supplied bill of lading and accept their load, can I deliver it on my own bill of lading?
Well, you can, but again, all parties involved will turn to that primary document. So it's important that all parties have a copy of that document. So if you, now, typically they're done in duplicate or triplicate. Typically the shipper gets a copy, the carrier gets a copy, and then the receiver gets a copy because all three of those parties are directly involved. So it's important.
Right.
And now I should step back a little bit. When you make a change, any change, even crossing out the carrier's name or some of the other things that we'll talk about here shortly, when you make any changes, it's important that all three of those parties or anybody that has a copy of this bill of lading, that it's identical. Because if there is any type of claim or any disagreement somewhere, again, this is a contract to make sure everybody agrees on the terms. If it's different, then it's void. And it could easily be battled in court that you used a different document and you're trying to change something. So it's important that all parties have an identical copy. But you can change what they have before you leave the shipper.
Like when I did LTO, we'd pick up on a bill of lading, and when we delivered it, we actually delivered it on a separate, you know, typed up hand bill that was, you know, totally different piece of paper than what the bill of lading was.
Now, when you deliver it, now, okay, and we'll get to who's responsible for certain aspects of it. Just as if you make a delivery and you just give a packing list, that may be all that you hand your final receiver, your final customer. And then there's also situations where you have a blind shipment as well, and I'll talk about that also. But in that case, the parties that are arranging this need to have the appropriate copy. So if a broker, for example, or maybe the carrier is making these arrangements to do these shipments, they need to have the final copy of the same thing that the shipper has, or however they have made the exchange. They need to make sure that the people that are involved with the exchange of money have the same copy. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can make up, and there are, and it's completely legal to do a blind shipment, and I'll get to a blind shipment here in just 1 minute. I do have one other question we'll take quick, and then I'll explain what a blind shipment really means, what that is. Jim in Indiana.
Yes, I had a quick question on some of the terms, too, on the freight bill is, like your prepaid and collect and your FOB destination and FOB origin. The FOB, that refers to when the stuff changes hands. And I just kind of wondering, too, on what I get frustrated is when I go to the dock, they say, back it in, and you're all set, and we'll come get you when you're done. And then they hand me the bill of lading to sign, and then they got on their driver account. And I'm like, you didn't tell me that, and now I'm blindly signing the paperwork, hoping they got the count right. So I just wondering, I wish sometimes my carrier would tell me that, but they don't seem to let me know that information in advance. So I was just kind of wondering some things on that issue as to driver count on piece counts and things like that when they load my truck.
Right. And okay, so number one is the name of the carrier. The number two most important thing is the shipper load count, not driver load count, unless they actually let you on the dock and let you count every piece or however they have it itemized on the bills. Typically, mm-hmm. they'll have a piece count, so they may have 20 pallets, but it has 2,000 pieces on there. And if they don't let you count it, then how are you to determine that there's 2,000 pieces? Then you get to the other end. And I'll tell you what, if you have one pallet and it's 2,000 gold chips, you want to make darn sure that not a single one of those chips is missing, right? And if they don't let you on the pallet or on the dock to count what's on that pallet, then you need to be really, it's extremely important to write shipper load count and never accept driver load count. Now, this is something right. that they're trying to sneak in on you, and you need to be careful not to allow that and make sure that you always write shipper load count. Now, I'll also say, I have notes on shipper load count as well. Shipper load count is not just some term that somebody made up. That is another federally regulated term. Shipper weight load count or contents or condition unknown to contain. Now, if they write something like driver load count, you might be able to put something else in there such as, shipper said to contain or contents or condition unknown. And if they won't let you write shipper load count, they may allow you to write those other terms, contents or condition unknown or said to contain or both or all, shipper load count, shipper weight load count, any of those terms. Now, that is a federally regulated line that you can write on there. And that is found under 49 United States Code 80113. So 49 USC 80113. specifically lists how that would be handled. Shipper load and count or contents or condition unknown said to contain. Now, what I want all of my drivers to do, every single bill of lading to have the appropriate carrier name, and I want all, every single bill of lading, every single one, I want it to say, when they sign it, write SLC. And if it has any documents or wording otherwise, or they won't allow them to, I want to be notified first. And quite honestly, if it's depending on the value of the load, now if it's trash, I mean, we've hauled recyclables and things like that where it doesn't really matter. And if there was a loss, it might be a few bucks. I'm not going to let them get into it. But as I said, you know, one of the things that we specialize in is some of the high value loads. And if it's a high value load and they don't let the driver on the dock to actually count it and actually see firsthand, in some cases to the point where every serial number of every piece of equipment or every little piece has to be documented, and then they try to pull some garbage where it's a driver count, no, that won't fly, because if you get to the other end, anything missing or damaged, it's on the carrier. So now, what that code, 49 USC 80113, if you write shipper, weight, load, and count, or just write initial SLC, or contents or condition unknown, or said to contain, if you write any of that, that protects the carrier from any losses or damages. So even if something happens to be damaged in transit, now this is something that can be extremely important, because some people don't think it's important to write shipper load count because they don't think the shortages matter that much. Now that might be, shortages might be a few bucks. You haul cases of produce, a whole pallet of, you know, some produce might only be a few dollars, you know, at actual cost. But damages that could arise in the shipment because it was not loaded properly, is that could be another problem that could be solved with writing shipper load count. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I encourage everybody, again, two most important things in a bill of lading: carrier name, the proper carrier name. Not a broker, not a shipper, but a carrier's name, and not the wrong carrier, but the carrier that's actually moving the freight, and shipper load and count. Anytime the driver does not actually have hands-on and is able to physically count it, and take that a step further, if the driver is allowed to count it, make sure that if it's something where it says there's 1,000 pieces on a pallet, but they don't let you actually count the pieces on the pallet, that should be notated as well. So it may say there's 20 pallets and 1,000 pieces. Say on the bill you might write said to contain 1,000 pieces, and that will protect you if there's any shortages on the other end. So it's very important to try to do that. Those two things can protect carriers from the majority of complications. We have some questions piling up here. Let me jump to Wes in Tennessee. Wes, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Yeah.
We can hear you. How can you help?
I was going to say, you kind of just covered what I was going to say, but I had one several years ago in Jacksonville, Florida, at Americold, where they would, the broker had told me to sign the bills as, you know, shipper load count, and they refused to let me do it. They would not. They tore the bills in half, reprinted them, told me I couldn't sign a shipper load count. Here, sign it. After the third one, they said they were going to they had to call somebody upstairs. Now, this is in August in Jacksonville, Florida, and I decided that I'd pull the truck away from the wall and close the doors so that the reefer would have half a chance of keeping everything frozen, because it was frozen product. As I pulled it away from the wall, walked back to close the doors, there was one of their dock guys handed me back my load locks. They were about to pull the load off the trailer, and right after that, I started getting calls from my shop that afternoon there. They were accusing me of being drunk on their dock. That was what they were going to do. And they were just going to, you know, because I wouldn't kowtow to their SLC, you know, their no SLC policy right off. They were going to try to screw up my job, among other things.
Wow. Now, did they actually let you on the dock?
I was on the dock, and that was what it was about. I was on the dock watching them, and well, it was butter is what the product was, and it had been frozen. But they would bring out the pallet, and they had this other pallet by the side of the dock plate there that had loose cases and loose pounds on it of butter. And they'd there'd be one or two boxes with the flaps open, and they'd put another one back in there. Yeah, on their, you know, and then put it on the truck. And I had told the broker that I, you know, what they were doing, and he said that this was, had to be chipper load, you know, I should sign a chipper load and count, and they told me that I could do that. They were not a chipper load and count facility is what he It was what he said, and he yanked the bills in half and reprint. You know,
well, I'll tell you what. The reason that you put shipper load and count is to guarantee that what they put on the trailer or what they say they put on the trailer is what's actually there. And it sounds to me like if they were taking products off the pallets and trying to jam them in other places, and we just lost Wes, but if that's what was happening, I think that Wes caught them red-handed. The reason that you put this SLC shipper load count is to avoid problems like that. And if the shipper was doing something that, you know, was a little bit shady, they did not want to put SLC. They were going to try to pin these losses on the carrier. That's exactly what they were trying to do. And it's exactly why, you know, why you need to stick to your guns on this. It's extremely important. Now, I don't know the value of butter, but it doesn't sound like it would be cheap. So certainly, I think he dodged a bullet on this one. I think that's the reason you do it, and it's absolutely a good thing that they tried to pull it off, and it's a good thing that it worked out. And hopefully there was no claim on this. Now, we have a few open lines. We have 10 minutes left tonight. I have a lot more I could cover. Sounds like I'm not going to get much past just bill of ladings, but I have more about broker-carrier agreements. I have more about owner-operator leasing regulations. All of these are contracts that everybody needs to pay attention to. But the bill of lading is, like I said, is the most important. It's probably the simplest document. But again, I've spent close to an hour now talking about nothing but the bill of lading. So that alone should tell you how important that is. Okay, so, excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. That's part of the reason I couldn't do the show last week. But, so, more things that are on the document, more things that are on the bill of lading, which should still be important or should still be notated, should read it. Again, anytime you have a written document, you should read every line. Read the small print. Name of carrier and sign it SLC. The shipment ID. So if there's a pro number or some shippers require the carrier to have the SCAC code, put it on the bill of lading for billing purposes. You should make sure if you have those numbers, make sure you put them on there. And the origin of destination should also be there because you're picking a product up. And the origin and destination are required. If you get pulled over at a roadside inspection en route, you should have the origin and destination on the bill of lading. It's required by law to have the origin and destination spelled out, written on the bill of lading. The shipper is the most important person on the bill of lading because if a broker fails to pay, the shipper becomes responsible for all payments of freight. So the shipper that's on the bill of lading is the person that the carrier turns to in case a broker does not pay. Now let me explain blind shipment again, because The origin and destination are required to be on the bill of lading. Sometimes the origin and destination are not where this load goes. So the shipper should be on the should be the origin either way. A blind shipment is not illegal, and it's not shady. There's nothing, you know, there's no crime being involved. Nobody's trying to get one over on anybody else. I hear a lot of complaints about this all the time, how a broker is trying to do something shady and skim some off the top because he's sending it to the wrong place. No, none of that is the case. What a blind shipment is, just so everybody is clear, is there's a middleman that is buying and selling these goods. It may be a retail store, for example. Now, a retail store, now let's say you go to a Home Depot and you want to buy a washing machine and a dryer. Home Depot doesn't have one on the floor, so you can't take it home with you. But what they'll do is they will buy it from the factory and have it shipped directly to your house. Now, as a carrier, if we pick that up, it will show the origin is the factory of the washing machine place, and the destination is Home Depot. But this is a blind shipment. We're not going to Home Depot. We're going to the other destination. So it won't match up. Now, sometimes they will print two separate bills. So your bill of lading may say the origin is actually Home Depot, because Home Depot, and I'm using them just as an example, they don't want you to want the end user, the customer, to know that they get it from XYZ supplier. Otherwise, the end user could go just directly around Home Depot and go to XYZ supplier. So what they do is don't allow that to be on the bill of lading that the end user gets. Hence, it's a blind shipment. And the same could go to the receiver. A receiver may sell something to a particular customer and have it delivered maybe to a job site. So the job site address is on there, but they don't show that it was actually going to some other company in the middle. And the end user is not privy to that information. They don't need to be. Their deal was not with that third party. There's no reason to put that in there. So it's a blind shipment. It's perfectly legal. There's nothing morally or ethically wrong with doing that. It's simply an efficient way for these middlemen to route the freight so they don't have to stock it on hand. And so knowing that, you should be able to determine what the proper origin and delivery destination is on the bill of lading. And we had a lot of callers, looks like, may have dropped off. We had a lot of other questions on. And maybe we're having some phone troubles tonight. We have a few minutes left. I may be able to go a few minutes over tonight, after all. So if you have any questions, I'll try not to cut anybody off. I'll try to get to as many questions as I can before we call it a night. As long as you get your questions in by 8, I will try to answer it. So you've got 5 minutes. Press 1 on your phone, and we will try to get you on the air. Okay, so origin and destination. Sometimes when the rate agreement, the wrong address on it, or I'm sorry, the bill of lading has the wrong address on it, what do you do? If it's a brokered load, you need to contact that broker and work it out with them. But if for some reason you can't get a hold of that broker to figure it out, always try to follow the rate agreement that you have. Whoever is paying the bill, go where they tell you. You can't go wrong if you go where they tell you. Now, always, communication is number one in this business. Try to communicate with everybody involved. Ask the shipper why it's the wrong address. Ask the broker what they want you to do. Do what the person that's paying you to deliver it, do what they tell you. Maybe they have a warehouse that they're going to drop it and have it redelivered. You get that a lot, for example, when you take a delivery to New Jersey. The final destination may be New York City. Well, they're having you take it to a warehouse, and then they'll cross-dock it onto a straight truck to have them take it into the city. Obviously, they don't want you taking it to the city yourself, because that's a whole other list of complicated problems. So always do what the broker or the customer that's paying you tells you. And if there's any reason why you shouldn't, make sure you work it out and contact them. Now, legally, if there's any shipment loss, cargo loss, damage, The carrier could be responsible. Now, the SLC is a way to help avoid that. But if there is a loss that goes against your cargo insurance, you are responsible, the carrier is responsible for the actual value, which means whatever the value, the declared value is on that load, not what they could have sold it for, not what it meant to them, not sentimental value, not some made-up number after the fact, but it's actual value. Now, if they declare that the actual value is multi-million dollars and you accept it and you say that that's okay, you may be held liable for that. But if it's actual value, it should be what is declared in the beginning. Now, you're not responsible for anything such as a plant shutdown or, for example, you have mail and you don't get it in time to make the sort, so it doesn't make it. You're not responsible for losses there. But you can be responsible for the actual value of what was lost. So if the mail didn't make the delivery on time and now it's dated material and it no longer applies, that sale will be over by the time it makes the next sort, you just bought that whole load. You don't have to pay for all the possible retail loss, but you do have to pay for what it costs to maybe print it and the shipment and the freight, all of that on you. The other thing might be temperature control. The carrier is responsible if there's a loss due to temperature control. On the bill of lading, things like this will be specified in a box called additional information. Also, there will be a box for COD, which means the shipper wants the carrier to actually collect a check. They're not extending credit to that receiver. That's tricky if you have drivers involved. So make sure you understand what's involved with COD shipments. Also on the bill of lading, and we have one more important question just came up that we'll get to. Also on the bill of lading is the hazardous materials checklist, the block. That'll mark that it is hazardous materials, and they'll mark that what that material is. And it's very important, that box, if you haul hazardous materials, and that's an entire different show, hazardous materials on the bill of lading is extremely important to be listed correctly. Now, the only way to do that is to get the information from the shipper and look it up in the required book. And again, that'll be a whole other show. And then declared value could also be on the bill of lading. Now, there's one box on the bill of lading that's important also to be aware of, and that's usually box 7 or on the NMFTA, they call it the for collect shipments box. And what that does is if the shipper signs in this box anything about releasing the goods to the receiver, if they sign off on that, the shipper is no longer responsible for payment on that. And that takes us to our question in Texas. Switchboard's a little slow, but Randy, welcome to the show. Randy, are you with us? And it didn't work for some reason. Let's see. Randy, there we go. Randy, are you with us? There you go.
Actually, it wasn't really on the bill of lading the question about this. It was in the contracts. I've noticed, because I've recently got started myself, that in the contracts they're having you sign away the right to bill the shipper if they don't pay, if the broker doesn't pay.
Exactly. Now, there's places that can happen. One is on the non-recourse box on the bill of lading itself. The shipper could sign off on that. Normally, the receiver would agree, then they would accept that responsibility. But by law, assuming that's not signed, if a broker does not pay, yes, the shipper is responsible. Now, and I didn't even get to broker carrier agreements, I may try to quickly skim over a few things, but anytime you waive a right in a broker carrier agreement, and that is one of them, you have to be very careful because you could be held on the spot if that broker, for some reason, goes out of business. Now, you could still go after the shipper, but typically those shippers demand that the brokers put that in their contracts because they assume that when they assign it to that broker, and one of the promises that sometimes the brokers make is that the broker will take that responsibility off the shoulders of the shipper. So that's why they put it in their contract.
Right.
You have to be very careful when you sign away your right on the broker carrier agreements. Now, have you ever crossed that off of a broker carrier agreement before you send it back to them?
No.
Have you ever tried? Have you ever considered it?
I considered it, but I've never tried. Like I said, Kenny, I've only been this third week, man.
Yep, and I'm, so. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I will tell you that that is one of the red flags that we try to negotiate on with every single broker carrier agreement we sign. And we're at a point now with as many trucks as we have running under us that we sign a new agreement at least one or two a day, because there are thousands of brokers and we're always working with somebody new. That's one of the red flags. Now, in Hank Seaton's book that I referenced before, TransportationLaw.net, there are 12 points that he talks about. Number one is a waiver of all of your rights and regulations, waiver of the Carmack Amendment, waiver of your right to salvage, waiver of all of this stuff. You have to be very careful when you're signing a broker carrier agreement to edit that. Sometimes they'll let you, sometimes they won't, but you can always try. If you need to, you may not be able to do it with the person on the phone, the agent that you booked the load with. You may have to go up the chain and discuss it with the decision makers in the corporate office, the attorneys or the legal department in the corporate office, but oftentimes you can negotiate these terms with them. Sometimes they don't even know how bad they are, and sometimes they have no clue what's in there at all. They've never even read them themselves. And so when you read it to them and say, this is what I think this means, they say, really? I didn't even know that was in there. Yeah, let's cross that out. Most people don't even bother reading the print. They just sign it the last page and they turn it back in. So be
right.
Careful about that.
No, I've been reading them, but I just, like I said, trying to figure it all out. You know how that goes.
Right. Now, I would highly recommend that you get Hank Seaton's book and read it cover to cover, because it goes over all this. So number one is waiver of all your rights and regulations. Number two is any language of indemnify or hold harmless. Anything that says that you won't hold the broker responsible for actions that they may contribute to, even if they are technically guilty of everything, even if they cause the problem, you will sign away your right and you will not be able to go after them for their losses. Okay? Any language that says arising out of could mean, now, that could mean that you go to a shipper and the person driving the forklift is loading your truck and he somehow backs over, you know, somebody else, a third party that's not even involved in this transaction, runs into him and kills him on the forklift on his dock, nowhere near your truck, but he's loading your truck. So that was a result arising out of your actions. You're guilty. You indemnify and hold harmless that shipper, and you indemnify and hold harmless that broker. You are the one that's on the hook because it was arising out of activities that you had absolutely nothing to do with. And these ambulance chaser attorneys will take that to court, and you will be paying. And it's happened. Now, that is an example that's directly out of Mr. Seaton's book, actually. So be careful of that language. Number three is the damages. All these are on the broker carrier agreements, things to watch out for. Damages. Anytime you waive the Carmack Amendment, which will waive that full value, the actual value, and you'll waive the limits of the retail or lost sales or retail limits that we had discussed a few minutes ago. Anything that has to do with damages, and you waive the limit, be very careful with that. Sometimes they will request that you have higher limits of insurance coverage, actually, that you don't carry. Most people carry $100,000. Some carrier agreements will ask for $250,000, and you'll sign it, turn it back to them, and they'll accept it, and knowing that you only have $100,000, and then they tender a load to you that's got a $250,000 value, and who's responsible when there's a $250,000 loss? It'll be the carrier.
You are.
Exactly. So you have to be very careful about the limits of insurance and also anything that's right to salvage. Now, some of these are give and take. You have to understand what you're getting into. So you may not want to waive your right to indemnify and hold harmless, but you might be willing, if you understand what's happening, your right to salvage. Now, imagine this. You have a load of produce. By law, if there's a loss, they're supposed to sort it out and mitigate and determine maybe only half the load was lost. okay? They have a, you have a right to sell that other half, or they can accept the other half. You only have to pay for the half a load that was damaged, okay? Now, you have to be careful not to waive that, all right? So, also, if half the load is still good and the receiver won't accept it, you have a right to find another buyer or salvage the other half of the load. That works for produce. But now let's say you have some multi-million dollar computer equipment on board. Half the load is damaged. And you do high, and let's just say you're insured for it, whatever. Half the load is damaged. They don't accept any of it. Well, this is all top secret government computer stuff. I completely understand that they don't want me to have the right to salvage that. Maybe
right.
some you know, bulldozers and things like that. You know, it comes in the paint scratched. Well, you're going to pay for the losses, but you don't get to salvage that $500,000 piece of equipment. See what I mean? So you have to look
yeah.
at, you know, what you're doing and the type of work you do, and maybe that salvage thing is something that you will give and take on. Also, sometimes the broker-carrier agreement. Now, the broker-carrier agreement will, even though the bill of lading, and as much time as I spend on that, even though the bill of lading will be the number one document everybody turns to, the broker-carrier agreement will trump all of that because the bill of lading goes off of what's established in 49 USC, okay? But the broker-carrier agreement is agreement that you can waive all of your rights to that. And you can waive your right to write the SLC on that. You can waive your right. Now, sometimes a customer might have multiple shipments or things, and they don't allow you to, as we had on that other caller, they don't allow the SLC because you may not be there when the trailer's loaded. And they don't want, you know, you're still taking the responsibility for any losses, and they put that in their broker-carrier agreement. Be very careful on that. If that's the case, that's something that you might want to cross off, contact their legal department about. The other one that's a big one that I have not had any success with, although I play hardball on this one, and that is no penalties for non-payment, meaning that all of them will establish a payment term, you know, maybe 21 days, 30 days, net 30 is a common one. They'll say, we pay you 100% of the load, net 30, but they don't ever establish what happens if they pay on 31 days or 45 days or 60 days. So they can do whatever they want, and there's no penalty. They say they'll pay at that time, but there's no penalty if they don't. You might be able to work into maybe your invoicing, or maybe if you can work it into a rules circular. And we have another question from wow, and I'm going to have to keep going here. I need to make a couple of quick adjustments on my equipment, and we will keep chugging along. We have a couple more questions I'll get to. Joe in Virginia and Bob in Tennessee, I'll take you guys, and then we will wrap it up. Let me finish up here with broker-carrier agreements. So no penalties for non-payment is another big one. And if you don't work it into that, and sometimes if you talk to, again, you talk to their legal department and say, that doesn't make any sense. What happens if you don't pay on as you agree to? Well, it's completely legitimate and acceptable to ask them to pay a late fee, maybe 1 or 2% late fee. I see a lot of them are 1.5%, which is 18% APR, which isn't too out of line. Now, you can't charge, you know, ungodly amounts, but you can charge a small late fee. And they should be held accountable and pay that if they're late. That would help you with some of the late payments. The other one is a Homer provision. Just to go back on this no penalty for non-payment, if you don't make them pay a penalty for non-payment, you're basically giving them an interest-free loan. Even if you allow them to go at 30 days, you're giving them a 30-day interest-free loan. If they go beyond 30 days, that's just uncalled for. So it's something to be aware of. Yes.
Can you incorporate that as part of your invoice?
You can incorporate it as part of your invoice. Trouble becomes collecting. Because if you sign off on it, if you sign that there is no penalty, you invoice them and you say that there is a penalty, there may be an issue with that. So it's something that should be agreed upon before. Now, certainly, that's something that's on my invoices. You know, I charge a penalty if it's not paid within, as agreed upon. Now, enforcing it is another matter. Trying to collect that trying to collect anything can be difficult sometimes, but trying to collect in addition to can really be something. So, but it's certainly worth trying, and it's certainly worth, you know, trying to hold them over the fire for it. And thanks for the call, Randy. And a couple other things quick is the Homer provision. And what that means is if there is any legal issues that arise out of a load, it will specify who and where any litigation will take place. So the broker may be in California, and you're, you know, doing a load between Ohio and Pennsylvania. The shipper, the receiver in Ohio and Pennsylvania, you're based out of, you know, one of those states, and then there's a dispute, and you have to go all the way to California to dispute it in court. So you have to be careful with that one. Now, you could change that to maybe your home state, or maybe you have terminology in there that says that where the infraction occurs. But that's another one that you may want to take up with your and this is something that's extremely rare. All of these are extremely rare cases. But it's that one time that it happens that it's very complicated. But again, that might be one that's a smaller one for me. That might be one that you give on. Now, some others that you want to look at are some back solicitation clauses, which are pretty horrible. Some back solicitation clauses, I've seen them where they may charge 30-40%. I mean, ungodly amounts. Now, here's the problem. You work for a broker, and you go haul a load for General Mills out of a you know, I live in Orlando. There's a General Mills place here. I go haul a load for General Mills. Well, you know, 3 or 4 months from now, I get a deal for General Mills on some other lanes they have, maybe in a different state. And I may be able to put 10 trucks on that lane. It's a great deal for me. I could buy equipment. It'd be great income. The money was right. But now, because I've already hauled that, and that's a Fortune 500 company, but now because I have this broker carrier agreement that I have to pay them 30 to 40% or whatever it specifies, that's something that needs to be clarified. Be very careful on back solicitation clauses. And also anything for non-recourse, which is if they specify in there that if the broker doesn't get paid, that you don't get paid. That's another one that's very important to go after. They should pay, just as a carrier has to pay owner-operators, whether the carrier gets paid or not, so should the broker pay the carrier. Now, we'll take these last couple of questions. Joe in Virginia, welcome to the show. How can we help you?
Yeah, hi. I appreciate taking my call. I just wanted to get your thoughts on the situation. Let's say that I get loaded and I have multiple stops. And
okay.
Well, I had two stops. At the first stop, I was not allowed to go into the dock. And so at the second stop, I ended up missing a pallet. And ultimately, I had to pay a claim. Like, how would I be able to protect myself from something like that?
Okay. Just as you put shipper load and count, you need to notate that type of stuff on the bills. So if you put there's two loads on a trailer, you need to notate that it's shipper load and count, first of all. And then if they unload the trailer, notate that the trailer was unloaded at the first customer, and notate if there could be any losses. In fact, I just recently had this happen to us. Just 2 days ago, I had this happen to us. One of my drivers took a load to a facility, and it was a split load like that, and they unloaded the entire trailer, not knowing, and they had to put half of it back on. And we made sure that they notated on the bill of lading that, you know, that customer, the first stop, notated on the bill of lading that unloaded entire trailer and reloaded the next stop. And that should protect you if there's any losses.
Okay.
Okay, but again, you still have to make sure that it'll show shipper load and count as well, or they may still come back on you. So shipper load and count, and then notate that the first receiver unloaded the wrong product.
Well, I mean, the whole point was I couldn't tell because, you know, I couldn't get on the trailer. I mean, I got on the trailer and strapped it in, but I couldn't tell how many pallets were still left, you know, on the trailer.
Right.
And how
well,
many they took
in, off. In a case like that where it could be questionable, notate that as well. Notate, you know, first stop unloaded trailer, driver not allowed on dock. Okay, just notate that what they did. And as long as you have documentation to back it up, then it'll fall back on them. But it's all about communication and documentation.
Okay.
And that's, and unfortunately, that's, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the call. And unfortunately, that's one of the games that we have to play out here. We have to make sure that we cover our hind ends with that. But sometimes, you know, we get hit with these losses and there's nothing that we can do. But the best we can do is to try to protect ourselves by documenting everything. And Bob in Tennessee. Bob, how can we help you?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Kenny, for taking my call. I'm running into the issue with brokers. When I sign the rate confirmation, I show up at the shipper, and the shipper says that there is no load. Somebody else, some other carrier took it, something happened to it, and I end up stuck, you know, without any work. Sometimes it happens to me on Friday, on Saturday, and I end up not working through the whole weekend. The carrier wants to pay me only like $150 for truck order not used, but for me it's just not enough for the weekend because, you know, I need to work, pay my bills. I pull produce, and it also it happens to me all the time in like Laredo and McAllen when I pick up a produce. It happened to me like 3 days in a row. And then some of the brokers, they even refuse to pay me for truck order not used. So this is a big, big issue for me. And it's kind of getting to my bottom line. And it's just, if it's going to keep on going like this, you know, it's just, I'm not making any money. You know, I'm stuck somewhere where I don't want to be. How can you, you know, help me with that to solve this problem?
Well, let me ask you a couple of things. Did you call in to Kevin's show a couple of days ago as well?
Yes, I did.
With the same basic question. Yeah, and I remember the call, so I heard that as well. Okay, and, you know, I was screaming at my radio because I wanted to answer this question for you. So thank you very much for calling in. There's a couple of things you can do. First of all, mentioned, all of this can be a part of the original negotiation. You need to open up your line of communication with the broker as best you can. You need to ask them as many questions as you can. The more questions you ask, the more clear that this whole problem will be. So now he had asked you if you'd ever done any studying, you know, about negotiation or anything. And I will tell you, you know, I have a few podcasts that you can listen to. So if you go to letstruck.com/audio road or just letstruck.com and click the link to Audio Road, and you can go to the Trucking with Authority show and look in the history, and I have several shows actually on negotiation. Talking to the broker is the number one thing that will help you avoid this, okay? Ask them a lot of questions. Ask them especially, and I understand Laredo and McAllen, they're waiting for produce coming across the border. And so we know, and I've been there. I know exactly what you're talking about. It happens a lot. Ask them how familiar they are with that load, with that shipper. Ask them how often they move it. Ask them if they can guarantee a time. Tell them that you are very familiar with Laredo and McAllen and that loads often get canceled. And tell them that you need a truck order not used. Agreed in advance. Agree in advance that they'll put it on the rate confirmation. If they won't, if they absolutely will not, there must be a reason. So if they completely refuse, you know, and they tell you that, oh, this load won't get canceled, okay, then will you please put in writing that there's a $250 or whatever number you want, put that on there, truck order not used, if I arrive. If they refuse, there might be a reason. If they are absolutely certain, 100% certain that that load is going to move, then they'll say, sure, I'll put that in writing because I'm not going to have to pay it anyway. That load's going. Okay? So that's the first thing you can do. Now, that's all part of the negotiation. Discuss it with them.
Okay.
Ask them more about the load. Ask them what you can do about avoiding truck order not used, avoiding a load being canceled. Okay? And explain to them the situation. Tell them that this is a Friday. And honestly, I've had some huge numbers. People don't believe me when I tell them how much I've gotten for truck order not used in that very situation. It's a Friday afternoon. My load cancels, and I'm in a place like McAllen or Laredo. And I have a specialty truck that I told you before. I do high value. I mean, that's it's important that my truck keeps moving. You'll have to pay me. And, you know, the it costs money to buy that truck for a day. And you've committed, you've bought the truck for a day, you can't not pay me, okay? That needs to be in the agreement ahead of time. Now, something else that I didn't get to tonight was a rules circular, okay? Now, broker-carrier agreements oftentimes will say that any other documentation, any rules circular will not apply. And they'll say that, you know, anything in addition to their contract won't apply. You can edit those lines as well. And you can make up your own rules circular, and I would suggest you do so because there's always items that are not listed in broker carrier agreements, problems that come up. And you can specify how to handle every problem, including detention time, truck order not used, layover pay. All of your rates can be published. And then when a broker comes to you and says, well, we're only going to pay $75 or $150 for a truck order not used, you can say, my rates are published. I get $250 for a truck order not used, or whatever number you come up with. It may or may not get you the money that you want, but it's a little bit more leverage in that negotiation because when that comes up, you enter into a new set of rules and in an entire new negotiation with that broker, okay? Now, I said all that to say this. When you book a load and you get the and you've worked out the money, you've worked out all the details, you worked out – now, the money is the last thing that you should work out. You should work out all the details like this. You should work out the time you load. You should work out truck order not used. You should work out appointment times, how fast the customer loads, all of that before you ever agree on a rate, okay? And then you agree on a rate, and you get a rate confirmation. Once you get that rate confirmation, you should call the shipper. Before you drive there, call the shipper and confirm your appointment times, confirm addresses. I actually make it mandatory that every broker or every customer, shipper and receiver, I have a contact point there because I call for directions or I call to confirm appointments, every single one. Now, if they refuse to give it to you, there has to be a reason why. And there's a surcharge involved in that. If they don't want to give you that phone number, or that contact point, and I would guess that most of your rate agreements have a phone number on them, and you just haven't called. So that's the first step in being proactive. Make sure you try to be proactive and call ahead and make sure your appointment time is there before you go on your way and drive there. Okay? Now,
yes.
That's probably the best advice I can give you in the few minutes I have.
Okay. That's pretty good.
All right.
The only thing is that with brokers, you know, it's kind of what I have noticed, unfortunately, that they're all, almost 90% of them, they are lie. They will tell you something that it's not. They will tell you that the load crossed the border already, and then you came out to find out that it didn't. They will, you know, I don't know. Maybe I live
on
a different planet, you know.
Do you know how you can find out for sure? Do you know how you can find out for sure?
How?
Once you book the load, call the shipper.
But sometimes they don't even, they send me a confirmation. There's no, like, phone number. And there's not even a pickup number.
If they do that, ask them for the contact point. Ask them who the contact point is there so you can confirm everything. Okay, that's the first thing.
Yeah, that's a really good
ask
advice,
them for
yes.
All right, so ask them for that. If they don't want to give it to you, ask them why. Okay, but be nice about it. Ask them why, and then ask them, you know, if for some reason that this load, if they assure you that the load has already come across the border, then that's when you throw at them, if I have any detention or layover or a truck order not used because it did not come across the border, this is my rate. And make them agree to that first. And if they can't agree to that, it's because they don't know. The way to flush out a liar is get them to answer more questions.
Yes.
Okay? So you can get them to answer more questions. If it's already coming across the border, what time is my appointment? If I'm there for more than 2 hours, I get X amount for detention. And if they don't agree to that, ask them why. And they'll spill it, well, because I can't confirm the appointment time. Well, there you go. Now they can't confirm the appointment time, and they don't want to give you a number. So it may be the way that you're approaching it. And I think the first thing you need to do is open up more communication with the broker, ask a lot more questions, ask why. The best question you can ask on everything is why.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Always
yes.
ask why. Always ask open-ended questions. Don't say, what time is my appointment time? How much does it weigh? Where is it going? All that. Say, please tell me more about this load. And let them
yes,
talk.
I'd...
And let them explain
yeah.
everything. Okay? If you ask pointed questions, they'll give you pointed answers. But if you ask open-ended questions, they will give you open-ended answers, and they will tell you, they'll start rattling off all the details that they otherwise wouldn't have, okay? So they'll start saying, oh, well, you know, another truck fell off of this, and I really got to get somebody on it, and it didn't come across the border yesterday. It came across today. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yes, yes, those are all really great advices, but there's a one little thing that I've noticed, that even if you ask too many questions, the broker, he will just like, you know, so do you want this load or not? It's simple like that. Even
there's,
if I
that's just a,
start
that
asking
is, that
questions.
Is that is just a negotiation tactic. If they don't want to answer questions, it's because they're trying to pressure you into taking a load without
yeah.
the information. So ask more
yeah,
questions.
That's what they do, yes.
It's just a negotiation tactic. And you can ask all the questions you want. You're the one with the truck. You're the one supplying the service.
Yes.
So with that, I'm going to have to cut you off, Bob. Again, please look into the rest of my podcast. I went half an hour over, even though I said I wouldn't. But everyone, thank you for joining me. Dream big, aim high, strategize your plan, realize your goals, and earn your success. Have a good night, everybody.